Tonight's talk is called The Inner Teachings of Buddhism. In July 1987, the conference was held at Ann Arbor, Michigan, in the USA. The topic under discussion at this week-long gathering was World Buddhism in North America. Those who came together to attend and give talks at this conference represented all the major Buddhist traditions in America. And there are quite a few of them. It is said that within walking distance of one another in Berkeley, California, are to be found Tama centers representing Burmese Theravada Buddhism, Korean Zen, Japanese Zen, Jodo Sinshu, and three of the four major lineages in Tibetan Buddhism. The sort of questions that the conference hoped to shed some light on were, how will these diverse forms of Buddhism relate to each other? What cultural and social forms will they assume in American society? How will they be understood by American minds? And what effect will they have on the world? Many forms of Buddhism arrived in North America via groups of immigrants from countries such as Sri Lanka, Burma, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, Korea, China, and Japan. Buddhism to these people was just their religion. In their homelands, they were never taught the Four Noble Truths, which are the most important aspect of the Buddha's teaching. They are the very heart of Buddhism, the inner teaching, so to speak. All these people were taught was ethics, how to pay homage to the Buddha, and how good it is to make offerings to monks. They were never taught the Four Noble Truths, nor were they taught any other aspects of the Buddhist teaching, nor were they even taught how to meditate. As a result, certain problems began to emerge after these Asians settled in America. The conference revealed that immigrants to the United States arrived in poverty and often in trauma. So qualified monks were brought into the country to help settle the people by serving the community in the same way that they had done back in their native land. All went well until these groups began to acclimatize and to succeed in the American culture. Then a new crisis emerged. The younger generation began to desert their native language, customs, and religion en masse, the Vietnamese being particularly notable in their ability to do this. It was decided by the religious leaders of these ethnic groups that the only way to appeal and thereby to win back these youngsters to Buddhism was to teach them the inner teachings. In other words, the Four Noble Truths. Another thing to come out of this conference was how often it is assumed that when a religion moves into a new culture, it degenerates, or at least it becomes something different. However, those at the conference thought that because Buddhism, on entering America, was forced to shed some of its outer cultural forms, there was a real possibility that the teaching would undergo a revitalization rather than degenerate. Certainly Buddhism, as it has moved from one Asian country to another, has taken on certain practices which has existed in that country long before Buddhism arrived. Practices such as shamanism, ancestor worship, and nature worship, as well as local customs of how to sit, how to dress, and how to behave. These different cultural practices got so absorbed into the teaching that after a time they are regarded as an intrinsic part of the way to enlightenment, when in reality, they had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the spiritual journey. once simple and clear message of how to overcome suffering and reach enlightenment, which the Buddha had taught, can so easily get bogged down with these add-ons. But it's quite difficult to dig one's way through to the inner teachings. And for the newcomer to meditation and Buddhism, it can be an impossible task, especially if their first association with Buddhism is to join one of these groups that emphasizes the cultural add-ons rather than the real message. Alan and I liken these types of Buddhism to a cake that is covered with layer upon layer of thick and elaborately carved icing. A newcomer can be so charmed by the sight and the taste of the icing that the cake is forgotten completely. Thus, the seeker never actually travels anywhere significant with their spiritual journey, but are under the illusion that they are really going places. Where they are going is that they are accumulating very detailed knowledge of a foreign language, much skill at the practice of exotic rituals, a recipe book full of unusual Asian dishes, and a new understanding of a foreign art and foreign music, all of which is a long, long way away from anything to do with the Four Noble Truths. So now let us take a look at the very core, the very heart of the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths. And in particular, let us look at suffering, the first of these Noble Truths. Birth, illness, old age, death, change, being parted from loved ones, having to associate with people we don't like, all of these are regarded as suffering in Buddha Dhamma. The forthcoming birth of a child is a happy event in most households. Everyone in the family, mother, father, grandparents, all look forward with excited anticipation to this new arrival. The mother may have some misgivings. Will the child have all its limbs intact? Will it be mentally normal? Will she be able to cope with looking after it? And how will the baby's presence affect her relationship with her husband? But on the whole, these worries are insignificant compared with the overall happiness shared by her and her family about the forthcoming baby. Consider for a moment what occurs soon after the child enters the world. The mother and father are showered with flowers and cards. Cards which read, "Congratulations on the birth of your child." Nobody ever receives a card saying congratulations when they are taken to hospital to die. Nor, if involved in a car crash, do they receive cards showing cars running into one another, which when opened read, "Congratulations on smashing up your body and your car." Definitely, some events are viewed by society as tragic, and others, like the birth of a child, are viewed as happy events, regardless of what fears and apprehensions the pregnant woman and her husband might have. These are swept aside. Birth is a happy occasion, an event to rejoice at. But Buddha Dhamma does not regard birth as a happy event. On the contrary, it sees it as an occasion for great suffering. The reason for this is because it looks at birth from the point of view of the being about to be born, rather than from the parent's perspective. Let's take a look at birth from this other angle, from the angle that it is not usually viewed from. The being about to be born first takes up residence in the mother's womb. It does not take up residence in a beautiful palace, in a luxurious bed covered with satin sheets and enveloped by air, which is gently perfumed with the scent of wild roses. Rather does the being take up residence in the belly of a woman, in a position that is below the stomach, where undigested food is stored, and above the rectum, where the remnants of digested food are kept. The birth chamber is between the belly lining and the backbone. It is very cramped and dark, and is saturated regularly with fragrance of bile, or phlegm, or blood, or excrement. For 9 months, the being undergoes excessive suffering, being cooked like a pudding in a bag by the heat produced by the mother's womb, with no way in which it can stretch or bend to ease its discomfort. Buddhadhamma views all of this as a suffering which is rooted in the descent into the womb. The child in the womb undergoes further suffering when the mother suddenly stumbles or moves or sits down or gets up, because the different movements drag it around in its cramped prison and jolt it up and down. When its mother drinks cold water, it's as if it's suddenly been reborn in cold hells. And when she eats hot foods or drinks hot liquids, it's like having masses of fiery ember showering down upon it. When she swallows anything which is either salty or acidic, the unborn feels as if it's undergoing the tortures of being pickled alive. Buddhadhamma calls this the suffering rooted in gestation. And all this suffering is undergone long before the child is even born. The pain which arises when the mother gives birth is enormous. The baby is flung from the womb into the most frightfully narrow passage, and then forced out the extremely narrow mouth of the womb, like an elephant being hauled through a keyhole. It's no wonder that one of the child's first responses upon coming into contact with this world is to cry. And the pain of birth is not over yet. The baby's body, which is as delicate as a tender wound, is lifted up by rough hands, then bathed or wiped down and rubbed with cloths, all of which is experienced by the newborn as something akin to being pricked with needles and gashed with razor blades. Buddhadhamma calls this the suffering rooted in venturing outside the mother's womb. We are born human only because we lust after experiencing the things that this realm has to offer. Therefore, we've actually chosen to be born. And it's rather sobering to reflect that we could do something so daft as to choose to put ourselves through the torture of birth. We must have a very masochistic streak. As we have seen, living in a mother's womb for 9 months is suffering. Being thrust out into the world through the birth channel is suffering. But choosing to be born in the first place is the basis for all kinds of suffering. We wouldn't open ourselves up to the pain of illness, the pain of old age, the pain of bad relationships, the pain of boring jobs, and so on, if we didn't choose to be born in the first place. Birth is just the beginning of a continuous, ongoing cycle of suffering. Buddhadhamma therefore calls rebirth itself suffering. I intend to go into some detail about the various experiences in life which are accompanied by suffering. not for the purposes of dwelling in a morbid way on a depressing subject, but in hopes of showing you that with the correct attitude to suffering, you can get yourself free of sorrow and pain. Buddhism divides suffering into three main categories: intrinsic suffering, suffering due to change, and suffering inherent in the formations. It also talks about concealed suffering, exposed suffering, and indirect suffering. But let's start with the first type of suffering, intrinsic suffering. Intrinsic suffering is all suffering associated with bodily and mental painful feeling. A businessman leaves home one morning. He's got too much to do. He's got a meeting in London at 10 and another one in Birmingham at 3. He's left home late. He'll never reach London by 10 unless he keeps up a steady 90 miles per hour down the motorway. He comes off the motorway too fast, misjudges the roundabout, and piles into the car in front of him, which is travelling at a much slower pace. As he's being driven to the hospital, he's wishing time and time again he hadn't driven so fast. If he hadn't been in such a rush, he wouldn't have had the accident, and his body wouldn't hurt so much. He's suffering. Buddhatama causes suffering associated with painful bodily feeling. A 19-year-old youth has just lost his girlfriend. She's gone off with his best friend. His girlfriend said he was boring. That's why she didn't want to have anything more to do with him. Her remarks about his boring temperament hurt. He turns over and over in mind how he's not really boring. She just doesn't know him well enough. She hasn't tapped his deeper side. After all, they had only been going out together for 2 months. He's dejected, distraught, feels insecure, unconfident. He's suffering. His girlfriend didn't damage his body, but her verbal lashings produced lots of unpleasant mental feelings within him. Buddhatama calls this suffering associated with painful mental feeling. The second category of suffering that Buddhism distinguishes is suffering due to change. This suffering arises when you are experiencing a pleasant bodily or mental feeling, which then goes and changes. It's quite the opposite to intrinsic suffering, which only occurs when the body or mind are filled with painful feelings. We don't normally associate suffering with pleasant states. Therefore, it can come as something as a surprise to realize that even pleasant feelings can have a sting in the tail and be the basis upon which suffering arises. Say you're lying on the beach in sunny Spain. You're thoroughly enjoying yourself. Your body feels good, all relaxed and warm and fit. And then suddenly you wake up to the fact that your holiday is almost finished. You come over all sad at the thought of this wonderful, relaxing, carefree experience coming to an end. Monday, the holiday will be over. You'll be back at work, back to your usual routine, back to the responsibility of earning a living, paying the bills, doing the shopping, mending the leaking roof, and coping with the squabbling relatives. You know that by Wednesday you'll be so immersed in the thick of life's responsibilities that your Spanish holiday will seem like a dream. Suffering only arose when you thought about how the pleasant feelings engendered by the holiday were about to come to an end. Pleasant bodily or mental feelings cannot last forever. All things come to an end. And when they do, those pleasant feelings change into something else. So Buddhatama calls this suffering due to change. The third major category of suffering is suffering due to formations. This is suffering that comes about when we crave for things. And there are three types of craving. Craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. Let me give you an example of each type of craving. Craving for sensual pleasure is when there is a seeking for something through the senses. You're always on the lookout for something. Like the little old ladies who spend hours peeking at passers-by from behind their lace curtains. They want to experience through the eyes. When you're in the garden doing walking meditation, can you manage to keep your eyes 10 to 15 paces in front of you, looking at the ground but not seeing the ground? Or are you tempted to look up and to look around and to see what flowers there are today? Which fish have come out of hiding? Who's walking in the Japanese garden? The need to see. It doesn't matter what it is you see, just as long as you see something. This is craving for pleasure through the eyes. Similarly, there can be a hunting around in the environment to hear something, or smell something, or touch something, or taste something. Many a meditator finds that they get caught up in dreaming about the forthcoming meal. What is it going to be? I hope it's spaghetti, that's my favorite. How much longer do we have to sit here? I really wish this meditation were over, so I could sit down and enjoy my dinner. And the mouth starts salivating in anticipation of the delicious flavors it's about to experience. This is sensual craving. It's craving for pleasure through the sense of taste. Craving to become means that you want to become something different to what you are in the moment. Whilst meditating, you notice you are stiff and tense, but you want to become calm. And so you niggle away at yourself about how you just can't get the hang of this meditation business. You so desire to be good at it. And the more you want to be good at it and become calm and settled, the more agitated you actually become. That is because there is present in mind the craving to become something other. And wherever there is craving, there is suffering. Which is why the meditation gets more tense, more saturated with suffering. Craving to become also means you want to go on and on and on. You want to exist forever. Perhaps you are feeling very settled, very calm. The state is mighty pleasant. You don't want it to end. You want it to go on and on and on. That's craving to become. When craving for non-becoming is in existence, there is a lust for annihilation. You want to destroy. Someone's snoring in the meditation. They've fallen asleep. They're heavy breathing in a rhythmical fashion accompanied by the odd snore. They're sitting close to you, and you find that continuous rhythmical noise infuriating. You want to destroy. You want to get rid of your ability to hear the sound, to say absolutely nothing of what you'd like to do to the snoring individual. From time to time, you may feel that everything is going wrong, that life is just not worth living. It's so full of difficulties and pain. You wish you could just curl up and die. At those times, there is a genuine desire to cease living. When such thoughts and feelings are running, it's called craving for annihilation. There is a craving not to become anything in the future. Apart from these three major categories of intrinsic suffering, suffering due to change, and suffering due to formations, the teaching also talks about concealed and exposed suffering. If you have earache or toothache or indigestion, such suffering is called concealed suffering. It's called concealed because the people around you are not aware that you are suffering, unless you tell them that you are. However, if you fell off a 30-foot ladder onto a concrete path, or were mugged outside the front door of your neighbor's house, then that would be obvious. They could see clearly that you were in pain. So such suffering is called exposed suffering. And recently there was a very obvious example of exposed suffering on the television news. It showed two army corporals in Ireland being dragged out of their car and viciously beaten by a hysterical mob as they accidentally drove through an IRA funeral procession. That is exposed suffering. If you've lost for hours in lustful or angry thoughts, that is also concealed suffering, just like the earache or the toothache. It's concealed because those around you, like your family, your friends and work colleagues, they won't be aware that you are suffering. They may notice that you look a little washed out, but they won't know exactly what the problem is until you tell them. Apart from birth and illness and accidents and change and bouts of craving and hatred plunging people into periods of great distress, aging too can bring on its fair share of mental and physical suffering. As a person gets older, they notice that their limbs get heavier, more leaden. It's more of an effort to get out of the chair and to walk around, compared to how it used to be when they were younger. In those days, they just jumped out of the chair and walked around without even noticing the effect on the body. It's common for hearing and eyesight to weaken as a person gets older. One grows physically less attractive to one's partner and relatives as the years roll by. Physical reactions slow down. Strength diminishes. Memory starts to fail. Intelligence starts to be lost. With the slow deterioration of a person's physical and mental faculties, others younger than oneself start to show contempt. All these things can cause suffering. Just as the prospect of getting old engenders much fear and suffering in some, so the prospect of dying also gives rise to suffering. Many shudder at the thought of the physical pain they may have to go through before they die. Medium Elizabeth Farrell, when recently interviewed, said that she was not fearless of what she might have to go through before death, but she was utterly unafraid of death itself. She'd been close to death herself once, and from her experience, what she expected to happen when she died was to find herself in light. And coming through that light would be people who loved her, who were waiting for her so as to guide her to a new life. But not many have her view of death, because they firmly believe that this is the one and only life they have. They do not accept that there's a life after this one. So the thought of it coming to an end fills them with a great deal of fear and trepidation. When you really begin to look at all the occasions in your life where suffering has occurred, it appears that it is riddled with suffering. It started from the moment you were conceived, and it will continue until you die, or so it seems. It looks like a pretty horrid picture. But is it as hopeless and as depressing a picture as it appears? Or, as we are going to be subjected to so much suffering throughout life, is it something that we can turn to our advantage and learn from? And the answer to the latter is a most definite yes. We have, however, to view suffering in the correct manner if we're going to learn from it. The suffering can just as easily teach us how to be bitter, how to be more cunning, how to keep our feelings locked up inside ourselves so we never get hurt by others again. Suffering can teach us how to be more self-protected, harder, more insensitive human beings. In order to learn and grow from suffering, rather than become bitter and twisted by it, we have to be aware of its existence in us as it is occurring within us. The more we look at suffering, the deeper and deeper we go into it, the more we notice its presence everywhere. With time, it becomes obvious to us that there is no escape from suffering in this life. That whatever we do, however carefully we plan to avoid it, it will eventually get us. Observing that suffering pervades everything, it suddenly dawns on us that there's no sense in fighting it. When we get depressed, we're fighting suffering. We're desperate to get away from all that unpleasantness we feel inside. The last thing we want to do is acknowledge the pain and just live with it. So we journey from this person to that person, or phone this person or that person, asking them to take the pain away, or at least to sympathize and tell us how to get rid of the pain. During all of this visiting and phoning, we're not looking at the pain. We are avoiding it. So it just goes on and on. When finally we stop running away from suffering, realizing that it's senseless to run away from it, for it's everywhere, we might just as well accept the suffering we feel and relax into it. When we develop this attitude, we settle down to watch its movements. And to our utter astonishment, instead of the suffering increasing 100-fold, because of this apparently stupid movement on our part of accepting and relaxing into it, we notice that the suffering is receding. Suffering always falls away when you stop seeking its opposite, freedom from suffering. To want its opposite is to become trapped again in suffering. The inner teachings of Buddhism state that there is a great deal of suffering in life, but that it only arises when the person craves. These inner teachings also state that when we stop craving for things to be different or craving for things to stay the same, then we are free of suffering. However, to talk of inner teachings makes it sound as if these teachings are secret, only revealed to the chosen few, but hidden from the mass of people who follow the teachings of the Buddha. In one sense, these teachings about suffering and how to overcome suffering are hidden. Not because teachers refuse to reveal the path to enlightenment to all who seek instruction, but because students themselves don't want to hear about suffering. What they want to hear about is deep, concentrated states, how to improve their relationships, how to love more, what special exercises and diets they should be on. They want to hear about past lives and other worlds and men from outer space. They want to hear about twin souls and telepathic union between peoples. They want to hear of all manner of psychic phenomena. They want to hear about subjects which will excite them and lift them out of their everyday, ordinary, humdrum world. They don't want to hear about something as ordinary and everyday and painful as suffering. Rob, on a recent bookselling trip to London, was informed by a bookshop owner that it didn't matter how good a book was on meditation or religion or enlightenment, or how well known in spiritual circles the author was, like Krishnamurti, for example, he's very well known. Still, people came in, leafed through books on Hinduism or Buddhism or meditation, and then headed straight for the shelves containing books on the paranormal. When they eventually left the shop, they had purchased something on telepathy, or past lives, or astrology, but never on religion. So why is there this resistance to becoming enlightened? Enlightenment, after all, is only permanent freedom from suffering. It is because people do not want to look at the ordinary. They do not want to look at suffering. They do not want to look at the cause of suffering. They do not want to do over and over again something as simple as watching bending, stretching, walking, sitting, standing, breathing. Exercises which help the mind to understand why suffering arises in the first place. They do not want to do something as ordinary and common as observing time and time again that sitting has ceased and bending has begun, that a change has taken place from one activity to the other. They do not want to observe how unsatisfactory it is that everything that one experiences just crumbles away. All this is very pallid, rather boring stuff. It has none of the excitement of a long, deep, involved lecture about sex and relationships. It has none of the excitement that is contained in a lecture on hypnotic regression into past lives. Only recently, I heard an announcement about an organization in London who are distributing leaflets about men from outer space who are out there in the upper atmospheres waiting for humanity to accept the idea that spacemen exist and to want them to visit Earth. Once humanity wants them enough, these spacemen will visit and they will start a new religion, hopefully setting up their headquarters in Jerusalem. This is the sort of thing that spiritual seekers want to hear about. It stretches the imagination, it's glamorous, it's exciting, and it's often the future. So a person doesn't have to do any work immediately at looking at suffering. It is for all of these reasons that very few discover the royal road to enlightenment. And yet everyone, whether rich or poor, educated or uneducated, man or woman, Western or Asian, all experience bending and stretching, sitting and standing. All experience frustration and anger and lusting, and freedom from these states. All experience pleasant and unpleasant feelings in mind and body. So all beings have the tools they need to come to enlightenment. All they have to do is consistently pay attention to these things coming and going. And gradually, the realization will come about that illness, old age, death, relationships, work, changing situations, pleasant and painful bodily and mental feelings are not suffering. They may be painful, but they are not suffering. They are only the basis upon which suffering can arise. Everything hinges around our view of these events. If we view them as painful and seek to get rid of the pain, then we suffer. If we view them as pleasant and seek to make them last, then we suffer. But if we view them as painful or pleasant and just experience, and in no way seek to alter that experience, then we do not suffer. Maintaining this approach through all inner and outer events means we free ourselves forever from suffering. This freedom is called enlightenment. Thank you. If you have any questions. Nothing? Okay. Okay.